And this session is a session on children and the law. This is an interest of mine, but it's not my main field. I worked for 5 years as an attorney in Philadelphia. And there, I was mainly doing construction with great big projects, factories and hydro plants and skyscrapers where something went wrong and everybody was fighting about who paid who. And I worked on issues of child abuse and neglect on a pro bono basis as volunteer work. In Philadelphia, there is an organization that trains attorneys to represent children. And so I worked with that organization. I was trained, I represented children through that organization, and then I served on their board. I also worked as a board member of an organization that was had programs directed at preventing child abuse, that intervening in high-risk families to prevent child abuse. And then the other activity that I was involved in related to this field was that I was the director, was one of the co-chair of a task force that got people together in the entire social service organization having to do with adoption and foster care. Got people from the courts, people from the foster care agencies, the city Department of Human Services in Philadelphia, and a lot of private organizations that were concerned in this area, and got them all into one room where they would yell at each other once a month. And it was wonderful because everyone was incredibly frustrated. They were all working at more than their capacity. And there were all these roadblocks that everybody was confronting, and they were like pointing fingers around the circle. And we get representatives of each of these organizations into one room, and they could say, well, it's the courts. You know, the courts are this huge bottleneck, and these children are just languishing. And the court would say, well, if you would send in papers that look like this and use forms, we could be much more efficient. And then the courts would also say, you're right, that particular procedure is really stupid and takes a lot of time, and we could probably streamline it. And other organizations would have similar, which I don't think qualifies, none of this I don't think qualifies me to lead this workshop. And I volunteered to do it just because I'm really concerned in this area, and I have more questions than answers. In fact, I don't have any answers. But I thought that Holden was a perfect opportunity to talk to people, other people interested in this topic, and to just really deepen my own understanding. And, you know, hopefully other people would become better equipped in their own communities to work on these issues. What I'd like to do today is to talk generally about children in the civil law system. I'm really not going to talk about criminal law. And it's about 100 years ago, except briefly, and all I want to say is that about 100 years ago, the juvenile court systems were organized in various, you know, sort of, it was a movement that spread across the country, and children started to be treated not as adults and thrown into prison with adults, but treated in a separate system in which there were more services, counseling, foster care system was devised. And there's a lot of dispute about that right now, about whether children should be treated in a separate system. What the basic assumption, the underlying theme both in civil and criminal law, is that children are incompetent, that they're not competent to make their own decisions. They're not competent in criminal law to have the required state of mind to, you know, to be a murderer. They don't have the intention or to steal. That they're assumed to be incompetent until a certain age is reached. And with that assumption of incompetence comes the assumption that they need assistance more than advocacy representation. And so people in the juvenile criminal system are often the movement is to say they need more rights, they need more representation. They're really not being helped by this parental attitude, and they should be treated more as autonomous individuals. I don't have any background in the criminal side of it, so I'm going to focus on the civil side, where the same assumption applies, that children are incompetent, they can't enter into contracts, they can't make decisions for themselves about medical care, and they can't act on their own behalf to change their family situation or have someone who is abusing them brought to justice. Someone else has to act on their behalf. And so the first thing I'd like to talk about is to look at that assumption and to look at how people in the civil juvenile system act on behalf of children. And so the first thing is whether this assumption of incompetence is legitimate, and at what point does it lose its legitimacy? I think that the legitimacy dissipates depending on what issue we're talking about. That I think there are 16-year-olds who are perfectly capable of entering into contracts and making medical decisions about their own bodies. And of course, children of three aren't capable of either of those. But on other issues, I think that children need to be listened to much more directly. There are two ways that the court deals with this incompetence and deals with this, the children with the assumption of incompetence. And one of them is to substitute judgment for the child and to say, if I were the child, what would my decision be? The other is to stand outside in a more parentalistic attitude and say, what are the best interests of this child? And I'd like to discuss that with you. It seems to me that if someone is trying to stand in the child's shoes, there are certain ways to approach it. To look at the child's background and what the child has done in the past and how this child is going to reach out into the world and act on his or her own behalf. That is more respectful of the child than the best interest scheme. The first thing I'd like to do is discuss.
I'd like you to talk about the difference. What are civil issues versus criminal issues?
Okay.
And that'll help me.
Yeah. Another thing we should do is go around and introduce the other people instead of me just plunging in. So why don't we do that first? Can you introduce yourself?
Okay, I'm Becky Bunky.
Could you tell where you're from and if you have any background in this area? Yeah.
I'm from Cedar Woolley, and I worked as a paralegal, and I've worked as a trainer in American Native courts, where we have lots of juvenile problems, and families, foster children need to be placed, and they need to be placed in Native American families. And also, my husband works for the school district, and he works with children that are in a preschool program, and they're put into public school now. It's a state mandate in Washington that after age three, and they are beginning even a birth program, that children that are showing developmental signs, social problems at home and stuff are put into school. And so he has to deal with a lot of those children and a lot of sometimes legal questions about that.
So these are special needs children in
yes.
preschool?
Yes, they have to meet two criteria of special needs. A lot of it is, he's a speech pathologist, and so a lot of it is speech problems with them. but they also have problems of either foster children or they've been taken away from homes or there is an alcoholic parent or something like that.
Mm-hmm. I'm Joey Goodwin and I've been here a year and I'm the substitute teacher and the head of the laundry and I'm decided my 9-year-old and I just since I'm a single parent, we have a lot of flexibility, and it would be nice to get out of the city, so we came here for a year.
So, how many kids are there that are here year-round?
The elementary is 5, and the high school is 7, and 2 preschoolers. Mm-hmm. That was last year. Now, this year will all be different.
Yeah. My name is Linda Hudson, and I come from Albuquerque, New Mexico, and I am an elementary school principal. My most significant work that I've ever done with children is to go to a rural community in New Mexico and establish a teen parenting program for that community. And what I saw, and I don't hear talked about enough, is that teen parents were often becoming teen parents because they were victims of incest. And the more that I work with families, I see that incest is a significant issue that we tend not to want to recognize. That's me.
My name is Jeff Misley. I'm from Portland, Oregon. I'm an attorney. But like you, my practice is pretty much confined to business law, real estate, and transactional type work. And my wife and I have 3 children, 9, 6, and 3, and we're here for the week.
My name is Walter Ilk. I'm from North Vancouver, British Columbia. I'm a contractor. I have 2 girls at 11 and 13. I have some experience with people who come to work for me over the years who have come through the system with a problem with children and some have run away from home and so on. Interest in the area.
I'm Sharon Andrews and I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota area. And I'm a parent. I have a 13-year-old and a 10-year-old. I'm also a special education administrator. I work for a special ed intermediate district. Coordinated hearing impaired program in 13 suburbs. I have about 400 kids in over 19 different schools. And I'm very much involved in legal issues related to plans for children in terms of special education. And been through many different kinds of scenarios with that. We're serving your young children, 2 months old, kind of all the way up through 21, and tend to work with a full range of kids. Obviously, helping parents understand their rights and become good advocates, and helping parents know what that means and that kind of thing.
I'm Tim Sherry. I'm from the Tacoma area and principal at Federal Way High School, which is about halfway between Seattle and Tacoma. And I have 1,200 teenage children.
I'm Anna Lampert, and I'm currently living in Chelan. I have a disability. Came from an extremely, extremely abusive family. With incest, physical abuse, every kind of abuse you can imagine, and some you can't. And so I'm very interested in this, and also something I found out about the law, especially repressed memories and getting some financial help to get my healing going. So, very interesting. And also, one of the things I want to do when I do get better is to do either advocacy or lobbying or something to set up information for people about child abuse. I think every person in a school should be trained to know and recognize child abuse and children, to know that they can tell people and who they can tell and that kind of thing. I think that's extremely important. I know that some will listen to them.
I'm Sig Nicholson from Dallas, Texas. I have no experience in the subject except 4 children and 7 grandchildren. And I work with the community ministry on a volunteer basis, which is a helping organization. and that's my only exposure necessarily to the families there that come in.
Judy England, retired librarian, mother and grandmother. I'm just here to listen. I have no area of expertise.
Well, my name is Sharon Tate. I'm from Bronx, New York, and I really don't have any experience on the subject, but I have seen a lot of the abuse, and I've even been part of it at one point in my life, and I'm just interested, especially the sexual abuse and things that happen to children in dysfunctional homes, because it's where I come from, it's just everywhere you see it all the time. And it's just so painful, you know. And I would just like to know what we could do about it to kind of mm-hmm. these things.
I'm Carla Wall from Seattle. I have four children from 12 to 19. And I'm also a high school teacher. So I deal with a lot of my students who have been abused. I teach at a private school. Most of the abused children that we have are out of the situation now, and a grandmother or an older brother or a sister, a cousin, has guardianship of the teenager by the time they get to our school. But they're still working through, of course, the results of their abuse in their home situation. So I'm always interested in hearing how the law can help.
Is this a special needs school?
No. No, it's just a private school, but there would be one, it's a Lutheran school, and there will be one person, you know, a grandmother who has been Lutheran and religious all her life, and she's rescuing a grandchild or a brother or a sister or a cousin is rescuing someone, and they hope that the environment in our school, which is very loving and small and students get a lot of individual attention, that this will be the kind of environment that the student can begin to thrive again. So we do have numbers of students like that.
I'm Judy Disselhorst. I'm a retired registered nurse. But I have a son who's an attorney who works with the Native American Indians also. And I work with my church through the women of the ELCA on their project, Women and Children in Poverty. We have quite a good project going in our church, and a lot of interested women, and of course it involves advocacy and different things that we can do. I come from California, Sonora Beach, and we're right near the migrant population. We have the migrant camps right practically in our backyards, and so our church, and through our project, we try to help women who are in the camps or who have children or are having babies mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. We just finished a big project where we brought necessities layouts and that sort of thing to these women in the migrant camps. We're working closely with what's called non-course chaplaincy. Mm-hmm. And this a pastor, he's a retired Presbyterian pastor, and he goes to these camps and tries to tell all the other churches what's needed there. So it's an interesting project, and our young pastor's wife is going to go back to the convention of the women at the ELCA. And it's going to be interesting. We're just one little congregation, of course, doing this, but all over the country, women from churches are trying to do something. So we are interested in the abuse part of it, too, especially the advocacy.
Mm-hmm. You had a question about the distinction between civil and criminal.
Criminal is real clear in my head.
Yeah.
I'm not sure what category
civil includes. What it includes in sort of the public law arena is abuse and neglect proceedings where
there's often a criminal aspect as well against the parents, that the state intervenes and takes the children from the parents. The parents may be charged with some kind of criminal charge as a result of the abuse that's gone on, but then the civil part of it is what to do about these children. And the social service agency of the state, or the city or whatever, public body it is, will have an attorney that acts to determine whether this child should be placed in foster care or be placed back with the parents, what kinds of services should be provided, and whether custody should be retained by the parent or transferred to the state. That is probably the biggest role in civil matters. And then once the child is removed, another big area of civil law is whether or not parental rights should be terminated and whether that child should be made available for adoption. And then another area of civil law that in which the courts are very much concerned is in custody in divorce cases. And that's the area where a lot of decisions are made about the best interests of the children, in which parent they should go to. There's really a distinction between the public activity and the private activity, and most attorneys do one or the other that I know. The public activity would be addressing abuse and neglect, and whether or not a child should be in the home. The private is these custody disputes, which are between two individuals. Most of the time, each of them are represented by a lawyer, and it can overlap into the public concern about whether these children are being abused and neglected. But my experience has been in the area of where there's state intervention to remove a child from a home. And then another area where the civil law is concerned about children is where there are issues of medical decisions that the state won't let the parents make. One of those is whether a child should be permitted to donate an organ. Most states require a judicial determination about that because it's not a medical decision directly for the benefit of the child. It's that they're donating it to another sibling or something. And then there's the abortion issues of whether a minor can give consent to an abortion, whether the state participates in that, whether parental consent is required. In all the states in which parental consent is required, there is a mechanism for a judge to make that decision instead of the parent. And so in each of these, they're disparate things, but in each of them, there's the issue of who speaks for the child and what kinds of decision-making procedures should be used on the child's behalf. Yeah?
Is there a common definition in the law about what is a child?
Different states define it differently. It's just an age limit.
Is it always 16, just age? 18,
yeah. And then there is the possibility in the law to have a child declared competent to make a decision for himself, so that in the abortion decision, there's two alternatives. Either you could go before the judge and be declared competent to make the decision yourself as a young girl, or
you can go before the judge, and the judge will say, well, you're not, you know, you don't show the maturity, you're not competent to make the decision yourself, you will make it for you, and then they apply the best interest of the child or the substitute judgment.
So the law always works that at a certain age, if they're not beyond that age, then the court treats them as a child, but then it may redefine that in the process and say, no, you are free to make that choice as an adult. Is that what being said then?
Right. Right. There's a presumption up to a certain age of incompetence. And you can either address that presumption and, you know, challenge the presumption.
If the court system makes that presumption and says that the young girl is competent to make a decision about abortion,
mm-hmm.
does that then say that from that point on that person is competent to make other adult decisions?
I don't think so. If that person wanted to then enter into a contract, right. Or gamble, or right. do other things that are prohibited for someone below the age of 16, say,
to me that seems
they
like
would
such...
have to go back to the court and right. say, well, now please declare me competent to enter into
that
the
seems
contract.
Like such an enormous paradox to on one hand, say that you're an adult for this part of what you do over here, but you're not for the majority of what you do.
I think the reason it happens is because courts want to make as small a decision as they have to. You know, they don't want to reach out into a general declaration. So that court will say, the question before me is this person competent to make a decision about this issue? And that's as far as they'll go.
And so you can have children who are very mature in one area of decision making and not as mature or maybe just naive about other areas. So they decide, I assume, based on that particular area.
Right.
And if you generalized it, I think it could become pretty chaotic and pretty scary.
The point, though, is that when you're, I'm coming from the standpoint of teenagers, when you're dealing with teenagers, you could say the same thing about a 29-year-old.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah. And some parents.
And so, the courts have created a process whereby it's pretty confusing.
Yeah. Do you have occasions where you're dealing directly with the teenager and the parents, even though in most situations the parents will be giving consent and so forth, you have teenagers that are really de facto and they emancipated and mm-hmm. acting on their own?
Mm-hmm. They're street kids.
Uh-huh.
We have lots of street kids who, they don't have anything. And they haven't done it formally necessarily, but de facto there's no point in us pressing the issue.
So you need a signature from your parent because then they'll just sign.
Right. So we're operating in a lot of never-never land too about not having any real legal basis to deal in certain areas that we have to because what do you do? They don't have any.
Mm-hmm. And then when you do that, do you generally deal with them as adults, or do you?
We deal with them as teenagers.
Teenagers, right? But the way the court is set up in this situation is that if there is not a guardian to act on behalf of the child, then the court will appoint a guardian ad litem to ascertain either the best interest of the child or the judgment this child would make if it was fully competent to make a judgment. And I think that's an area we need to explore some more. You know, what is there a difference between that? And what it is, and what a lawyer should be doing, or this guardian should be doing, on behalf of children. That someone like that would be appointed. Do you ever call on that system, or are these kids basically on their own confronting the principal with no guardian assisting them?
They don't want that system to be involved. So. We try to make do if we can't find any way to plug into the system. If there is somebody that we have to deal with, we do.
Mm-hmm.
And we should, you know, but expediency is so often the rule of thumb, and you have to get things done and get on with it and get kids not quick.
Right. We've had a similar situation many times in special education where a child is close to becoming 18, and it might be a benefit to the child in Minnesota to make a stand, go to their 21 and take advantage of some of the vocational options or whatever. But to be able to do that, we have to appoint them either awarded the state or a guardian or that kind of thing. And we have difficulty getting the system in place quick enough to make it happen. Because even if we started there, sometimes it's the beginning of their senior year, by the end of the year, it still hasn't happened. And so it's very frustrating in terms of the backup. As to know, sometimes, to be honest, if it's worth the time to do it.
Because the kids are ambivalent about whether they want to go on to school or whether they want to go on their own.
Right. And you have to keep going through such a lengthy process with a child who doesn't even know if they want it. Mm-hmm. And you have to kind of talk it up as a good thing, and then when it doesn't happen, it's so hard to keep them interested.
Now, why do they need this?
Because they can take advantage of some vocational options and some post-secondary training options that seem to benefit them down the road vocationally.
And kids who have parents in place advocating for you don't need this.
It's
the ones who.
And then we have the opposite situation where the parents have concluded that the child would make the decision that way, and we're saying that it's not in the best interest of the child to continue for those extra 3 years until the age of 21. So it's real interesting. And legally, I think the school systems, at least in the state of Washington, through a process can have the final say about whether that student stays after the age of 18.
If the decision makers are deciding in terms of the best interest of the children, the question then is, how do you really get the best interest of the child? As opposed to, you know, what you said, the parents have this idea. I mean, it's in their interest to keep the kid in school 3 more years at the state's expense and out of our hands. I have a quote here that talks about this. This is a court in a guardianship situation in Wisconsin. Said, those who normally would speak for the incompetent, parents, guardians, or even social workers, may in actuality speak, consciously or unconsciously, in their own interest, diminished worry, convenience, a wish to be relieved of responsibility for close supervision, or frustration at their inability to deal with the most difficult problem. These very considerations may be indeed in the interest of the incompetent, but not necessarily so. And the issue is how do you, if you're going to be defending a child, how do you speak in a way that's in the interest of the child and sort those things out?
I'm a mother and father who would not speak the extra 3 years. California has that too. And my good friend, who was a teacher of exceptional children, tried to talk to his family that he was entitled to these extra 3 years. She just couldn't get them to apply for it. And so consequently, the boy sat around home mostly. You know, he was really just sad that they didn't take advantage of what was there. I guess that's what you've run into.
I think, you know, to me it's about a continuum of, you know, best interest. Obviously, I think abuse and verbal harassment and those kinds of things are on one end of the continuum. You know, 3 more years of education might be on the other end, and I think somehow in between, you know, we need to be supportive of a system that expedites, you know, things that need to be dealt with quickly, as opposed to, say, I mean, all of us might have a different perception of what the best interest of a child is in this room. But I think that somehow there needs to be a better system in place to deal with issues that are very, you know, negative in terms of children. And one of the things that we're talking about, 3 more years of education are niceties, and others luxurious might be too strong. But I think there's somehow a continuum, and I just like the system to get better at dealing with I agree that things have well moved.
Yeah. Yeah, and that has a lot to do with funding, but it also, I think, has to do with the fact that courts in general are slow moving, as you, I'm sure, know. And
very slow.
Yeah.
A question that I have, that I don't want to be perceived as being cynical, but the question that I have is the law as it is currently practiced, is it capable of being an investment district? Because if some of the decisions that go on and I made over very long periods of time with lots of convolutions of process and so on, how can that be in the best interest of what we define as a child who's struggling to grow up and learn and mature and so on? Some of the things that are decided in the best interest of children aren't that.
Yeah, I think following up to that, I think the Washington State, the Eli Friedman case for those in Washington State, you know, the child died,
do we?
That the social services and I think the grandmother of the child stood there and was saying that the child should be taken away from the home because of the abuse that was happening. Now, it almost comes down to where a child has to die before action really happens.
Oh, in custody cases, is it generally in most states that they have an agent where a child can decide who he wants to live with, mother or father, isn't it about age 14 in some states?
I believe, I don't know many states, but my experience is in Michigan and Pennsylvania, and there's an age at which, in divorce situations, mm-hmm. they're consulted. And it varies. I think in Pennsylvania it's 14 and in Michigan it's younger. But that also seems so arbitrary to me that, you know, that they wouldn't ask a 10-year-old who I'm sure has a strong idea whether or not that 10-year-old's idea should necessarily be followed is another question, but that they're not even asked to consult a child. Well, they're not required to.
Well, I was wondering, like, you know, an annual divorce case where now the mother has to give the child up for every vacation, and she works, and so consequently she never really has any time with the child because the child has to go to her father. And I think the child isn't consulted at all in that case. She's 8 now, and she very much would like one vacation with her mother anyway. She immediately has to go back to the father in California, and she lives in New York. Mm-hmm. That's really hard on them.
Part of the problem that you just mentioned, and you see this in other areas of the law as well, really boils down to the financial thing. And the courts are tremendously understaffed. There's a tremendous backlog of cases. There's short, you know, not enough judges. Like in Oregon, with Measure 5, cutting back on all social services, uh-huh. things like that. Really just creates a logjam. You know, there's not enough resources to quickly process cases and handle, you know, do them well.
Yeah, there are lots of just frivolous cases taking up court time. Bill Gates, multimillionaire, just took court time the other day to fight a $47 traffic ticket in Seattle. I mean, that's nonsense. You know, it's not valuable court time somebody else could have used. So. Yeah. There's just a lot of that garbage falling.
And the thing, I know my parents divorced when I was 15. And there were 4 of us. And they didn't fight about which one had which child. They fought about who got stuck with the kid. And yet, no one in the court system knew that they were feeling this way. And my mother said, it's too bad you can't divorce your kids when you get divorced. Yet, if my father had wanted custody of us and fought for it, she would have fought against it just on the principle of the thing, not because she wanted us, but because she didn't want to look
form in the community or whatever. But I remember that fight and I thought, geez. and none of us were ever consulted.
Even though you were 15?
I was 15. My older brother was close to 17. My younger brother was 14. My younger sister was 13, was 6. None of us were ever talked to by anyone in the system.
That's what I mean. And there isn't a system in the divorce courts for this. There isn't an office of, you know, friend of the children that children can go to. In Grand Rapids, Michigan, a group of people 2 years ago founded a children's rights, I don't remember what it's called, but it's a children's rights organization that sends flyers to all the middle schools and high schools that says, you know, the kids, you have rights. If you have a problem, if you're being mistreated, if things are terrible, call us. And there's a line that kids can call and get somebody to talk to about this stuff. And one of my son's friends, he comes home and says, well, you know, this happened. So I've given him the brochure a couple of times to have this kid call and they can get legal representation from here. At the current time, I'm working for the court, and so I can't work as an attorney. So I'm feeling like my hands are tied, and I can hand out leaflets, but that's about all I can do.
And the puzzle thing with a child, because, well, a lot of the severe trauma gets repressed. And even as a child, I remember thinking that other kids were just spoiled. And I was lucky because my parents were strict and that would make me a better person. Anyway, and if someone had asked me, a big part of me wanted to get out of that house so badly. But the other part, like all children, loved their parents. And it's such a struggle, and then the fear if someone finds out, what if they make the decision to send me back home? Do you know what kind of trouble I'm going to be in? For having said something?
Right.
So it is very frightening for children.
Well, you probably all read about the case in San Diego where the little girl was taken away, 8 years old, and her father was accused of raping the child, and she had told all along that it was somebody who came in through the window. And there was a known case, a guy who had been arrested for doing that right in that same neighborhood. And yet they didn't believe the child. And she was in a foster home for a whole year. And finally she recanted her story and said, yes, her father did it. And all the family just spent lots of money to get the child back. And she was about ready to be adopted, you know. And he's suing the city of San Diego, the social service.
The father who raped the child,
he didn't do it, or he did?
He didn't.
He didn't do it.
No. And it's been proven that this
that other
man did it, who'd been raping other children, doing the same thing in the same neighbor. That was never looked into. And that was what the little girl had said. They were in a Navy project, I think, or some kind of housing project. It was a real low window, and I guess somebody had come in and taken her out. And she had told the story for a whole year, the child, 8 years old, had repeated the story.
To hold on to that story for a year.
Yeah, she did. And then finally, she was with a foster family who wanted to adopt her. And I don't know, I think they kind of bribed her or something. Her natural father and mother have her back now. It was really a skip the headlines for weeks and weeks.
What kind of things are listed subjects that we do?
I don't know. As a non-Lutheran, I'll have to ask other people about that.
Well, I'm sure they counsel people.
The only thing I know, I guess maybe I answered my own question, but for Northwest Washington Senate, we have a representative who works with the legislature for the state of Washington. What he does is help with the interests of the Lutheran Church background. And one of the things that, although child welfare hasn't been part of my agenda of Native American concerns has been, but I work with him both directly and indirectly and trying to help make sure that Washington State Legislature hears what the interests of the both the Lutheran Church per se and influencing state government.
We have that too in California, but we have a person in Sacramento who watches the whole bill.
And what you said about the lock-in and the courts, and what you said about the slowness in itself, meaning that children's interests are protected, means that funding of projects, of the system that handles this, is so important because in most areas there's a separate court for abuse and dependency issues. But when the other courts are underfunded, that one too gets squeezed. It's not that it's competing for slots in front of the same judge usually, but they're, you know, if all the judges are overstrained, they're taking judges away from the children's court and putting them in criminal court. That was happening in Philadelphia all the time because they had to try people within a certain amount of time or they go free. And so the juvenile judges were disappearing all the time. They, you know, I'd have a date and I'd show up and the judge would be gone. And of course they never told attorneys that they had just reassigned the judge for the week to handle criminal court. And so these children who needed a decision made because they needed to transfer out of custody into some other place, or they needed a different school, or they needed medical care, that if a child is in foster care, their parent still needs to approve anything that's not a routine medical care. And if the parent is not available, you have to go to court to get court approval for that medical care. And that's not something that can wait around. And then the judge would be assigned to the criminal court.
Does the definition of child neglect vary from state to state, or is there a universal definition of abuse neglect?
I'm sure it varies some, because each agency, you know, will write up its own definition as part of its understanding of when it has to intervene and so forth.
Does that apply only to parents?
You mean as opposed to what?
Well, big question, you know, I still haven't come to grips with whether or not the United States likes children.
Right.
I've concluded that it doesn't. And I'm getting ready for the lawyer who is clever enough to sue the court for child neglect. Mm-hmm. Because they go into the criminal rather than children's.
Actually, sue
the social service agency that has a bureaucracy that is so cumbersome that the child dies.
Who's named the children's organization?
I think in Minnesota one of our difficulties too is that there's, and I'm sure this is just law, but there seems to be so many fine lines as to at what point you're willing to take the energy to push. For example, we had a little girl who had osteomatoma, which is a familiar problem. The parents refused to take her in for medical treatment. It caused a rupture of the middle ear, which caused severe hearing loss. You know, to me that seems to be an issue of neglect, and yet when it came down to can we push the parents and the school system, who's going to do it, no one, you know, really felt like it was clear as to whose problem was it. You know, obviously the school would bother the parents that never come for a conference all year long. Is that neglect? The fact that the parents never come to school for a parent conference? I mean, at what point, and even when we looked at the definition in Minnesota, there were so many fine lines. And, you know, it was hard to know whose problem it was. And so it becomes no one's problem.
Actually,
it
becomes the child's problem.
Right.
Yeah.
And I find that to be the most frustrating, because there seems to be a lot of fine lines and a lot of issues that just make me really upset, but it's like, who's going to take them all?
What about these adult children who sue their parents for their abuse and neglect later on. I've done a lot of cases after they've grown.
Often when an abusive family, you don't realize it's abusive. I mean, you may not like it, but you know, what kid likes their family all the time? You don't know any. And when I was growing up, it wasn't talked about, and even now. And a lot of things with real traumatic stuff come up as repressed memories. And you don't find out about some of the more horrific things until you are much older. And so it gets complicated.
Right. But suing as an adult is not the answer. What needs to be done is to prevent it. And I have here a package of actions that have been, this whole book, are actions that have been taken against various governmental entities on behalf of children who've been abused.
But a lot of children don't recognize that they're being abused because this is how they've been brought up ever since they were born. Yeah. So if this is the way I was taught, then how would I know the difference if I don't see anything else and this is all I see?
Yeah. I heard a radio program about a month ago that was talking to adult women who were in prison because they had abused their children. And it was just a heart-wrenching program. And what these women basically said was, you know, some of them said, well, this boyfriend that I was with, maybe he wouldn't, you know, and I couldn't get away from them, and talked about being in a victim situation. Others of them, the most heart-wrenching, were women who said, this is how I was raised. You know, I knew it hurt me as a child, but I thought it was the way you had to raise my child. And I didn't know it was wrong. And now I feel terrible, and now I know it was wrong. And now I'm not going to see my daughter until she's 16, and I hope she forgives me. It was. And for that kind of situation, intervention needs to happen. And then the question is, how do you identify? And what kind of intervention? I have a number of
calls. It's very hard because I
can.
For myself, I was an adult before I even mentioned some of the abuse that I experienced to my mother. And she was so saddened about it because she was, you know what, why didn't you ever tell me? First of all, I think possibly because I didn't think she would believe me. You know, and then always the abuser is always the one to tell you, well, this is going to happen to someone in your family or to you if you tell. So you feel like you're protecting, you know, these adults, and you're just a child, not knowing that if you tell them, they can get you out of this mess, you know, so.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Or if the perpetrators are your family.
And that's true, too. That's true.
Yeah,
that's even trickier. I was in a situation where I was abused by a friend of the family. Mm-hmm. And I didn't tell my parents until he was arrested when I was about 35. Mm-hmm. And my parents were, you know, behind him. Mm-hmm. Our friend is being falsely right. accused. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I said, we have to go out to lunch. I have something I need to tell you. And, you know, they were, because at first I didn't tell them because I thought, they're not going to believe me. And then once I had, it stopped when I said, I'm going to tell you, stop doing this, don't you ever touch me again, I don't, you know. Then I felt like they still wouldn't believe me, plus I was such an idiot for not having done this sooner. Mm-hmm. You know, if I could make it stop, why didn't I make it stop 2 years ago, you know? Yeah. Except that then I was 10 and now I was 12, and you know, but I blame myself for not, for having put up with it. And then, you know, once a year or two had passed, I kept an eye on all the younger girls I cared about to make sure it didn't happen to them. You know, that's as far as I went until this. And then I felt like, oh, it hurt my parents so much that I didn't have an answer. So it wasn't until I was really forced by, you know, this outrageous behavior of my parents to be defending it, you know, that I just had to do it. And there's a lot of kids who are abused that you'll never know, but what she was talking about situations where you see something and you think it's the tip of the iceberg. Then what do you do? And what kind of power do you have to explore further into that family? In America, rights are generally defined as rights to be free of government intervention. For adults, you have rights to do the things you've set out to do and not have the government interfere, except to a certain extent. And with children, I think what we're talking about is that they need more positive rights spelled out, that they can stand on. What has happened in these actions, these lawsuits against various institutions about the care that kids have gotten in foster care, is that many of them, the court decides that the agencies that are providing the care, the people are entitled to qualified immunity because the right was not clearly established. Let me talk more next time about those actions. And what I'd like to focus on next time are abuse and neglect cases. The next session is tomorrow at 3:45, and it'll be here. And I have right here some literature that I'll leave out in this reading area right here. This is called Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, and it talks about, it has a number of proposed model standards for protecting children, but also protecting the rights of parents. And I think there's a lot of debate about the lines that are drawn here. So this, I think, is really interesting to see, you know, where the parents' rights are and where the children's rights are. Yeah?
A final thought that I will have is that, again, depending on our definition of children and what being a child is all about and what we should be doing to support that, I'm in the funny position now as a high school principal where I'm really worried and even to the point of being afraid to treat the kids in my school like children and behave towards them like children for fear that something will be done to accuse me or whatever. I don't touch any of them.
I know.
And children, I think, have completely need touching.
Yeah.
And I don't do that. And so it's been fascinating for me over 20-some years to watch a system, the schools, which was designed to nurture childhood and grow into back away from it.
Right. There's a big article in our San Diego paper about the San Diego schools, the policy of teachers have about not touching children. And,
oh, and when it extends to the preschool, right. It's really
right.
Troublesome.
Because right. That's what
we do. This other one is about how foster care can hurt children, which I think goes along with that. And then I have a few that just sort of set out the court rules for that whole process. So I would leave those out there. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And then this is the issue I want to take up on the third session, which is the adoption and various issues about custody. Who should have these children?